Think Victorian England conjures images of buttoned-up moralists and joyless Sundays? Think again. That famous phrase, "we are not amused," supposedly uttered by Queen Victoria herself, never actually passed her lips. It first appeared in an 1885 novel before being falsely attributed to her. The truth is far more colorful. 19th-century Britain pulsed with entertainment fever. While reformers did champion rational recreation through parks and museums, ordinary people craved something else entirely: spectacle, excitement, and a little bit of danger. The 1899 Greater Britain Exhibition at Earl's Court captured this perfectly. Yes, it had educational exhibits, but what really drew the crowds was a towering 300-foot great wheel and a wildly popular water chute where Britons enthusiastically practiced what one observer called the British pastime of shouting. This wasn't a society afraid of fun. It was a society inventing the modern entertainment industry, transforming leisure from occasional festival entertainment into a sophisticated commercial enterprise that would generate millions in revenue and shape modern culture for generations to come. In 1830s London, gin palaces emerged as dazzling anomalies. Gaslit establishments with etched windows, gilded decorations, and polished mahogany blazing amid poverty. After the 1825 duty reduction made gin affordable at 212 shillings per quarter pint, these opulent venues became accessible to the desperately poor. What troubled middle-class observers wasn't just the drinking, it was architectural flourishes typically reserved for respectable shops now serving ragged customers. The gaslight itself sparked controversy. While reformers praised street lighting for deterring crime, gin shop lights were condemned for luring victims to ruin. Critics attacked the multiple doorways, lack of seating encouraging rapid drinking, and stained glass that seemed better suited to churches. Yet, publicans cleverly circumvented restrictions. When the 1839 Metropolitan Police Act prohibited Sunday opening before 1 p.m., landlords told customers to bring your jugs and bottles on Saturday night. Despite temperance campaigns, the modern pub had established an enduring template: counter service, ornate decoration, and visual spectacle prioritizing customer experience. The 1843 Theatres Act created regulatory chaos that sparked an entertainment revolution. Pubs with music faced licensing confusion. Some were denied approval despite proper licenses, while 7 establishments with pub theaters received special saloon licenses. These remained rowdy venues where fights erupted and hawkers sold pig's trotters. In 1849, authorities threatened to revoke liquor licenses from establishments breaching entertainment rules, panicking East End publicans where virtually every house employed unlicensed musicians. The 1851 solution introduced a two-tier system, music only versus music and dancing licenses. Magistrates could crack down on boisterous dance halls while permitting musical entertainment. Music-only licenses outnumbered music and dancing applications 4-1, giving publicans a legitimate path to invest in concert rooms. Charles Morton's Canterbury Hall in Lambeth, 1852, became the first purpose-built music hall, 1,500 capacity with ornate decoration, gaslighting, and a proper stage. Morton positioned his venue as respectable, banning prostitutes and employing his wife and daughters as cashiers to emphasize family values. The Canterbury's success inspired rivals: Weston's, Wilton's, the Pavilion, the Alhambra. Music Hall had evolved from humble pub entertainment to major commercial enterprise. By the 1860s, music halls faced fierce moral criticism for crude performances, blackface minstrels, and provocative lady serio comics. Women cross-dressing as fashionable men sparked controversy, while double entendre dominated comedy performers routinely denied the innuendo central to their appeal. Singer Lottie Collins won a libel case against vulgarity accusations despite her provocative widow act. The gravest charge was harboring prostitutes. In the late 1870s, social purity movements combining evangelical religion and radical feminism intensified these concerns. The 1888 creation of the London County Council gave reformers unprecedented licensing power to purge halls of prostitutes and coarse entertainments. Yet these campaigns achieved little. Marie Lloyd delighted in taunting Puritans, while comedians continued suggestive material. Music halls became respectable in the 1890s, but through abandoning alcohol sales, not moral pressure. Proprietors severed ties with public houses, replacing shared tables with theatrical stalls and restricting alcohol entirely. This transformation targeted the growing lower middle class and their disposable income, proving market forces trump moral crusades. Commercial dance venues reflected Victorian Britain's rigid social hierarchy. Assembly rooms, ornate neoclassical venues in county towns and resorts, served society, with high subscription prices ensuring exclusivity. Masters of ceremonies excluded improper company. Fashionable venues like Bath and Cheltenham barred anyone in retail trade or theatrical performers. Pub dancing developed from public houses, where publicans hired fiddlers for customers. Maritime districts featured long rooms, catering to sailors with money to spend. Though condemned as haunts of prostitutes, these venues provided principal recreation in port districts. Working-class dancing defied stereotypes of undisciplined jigs, reels, and hornpipes. While Henry Mayhew described costermongers' vigorous, laborious capering at Twepenny Hops, his collaborator noted the accuracy and grace of East End dancers. Ballroom dances appeared in humble settings, waltzing in Wapping, quadrilles, and beer shops. Even the polka reached English workers after upper-class adoption, demonstrating how cultural forms moved both up and down the social ladder. Football evolved dramatically throughout the 19th century, from festival amusement to public school character building. Amateur clubs emerged playing either the physical rugby game or skill-focused dribbling game. The Football Association's 1863 founding favored dribbling clubs, creating modern soccer and splitting from rugby. Outside schools, football thrived as a Shrove Tuesday tradition in towns like Derby and Alnwick, where hundreds battled to move the ball to distant goals. Magistrates increasingly viewed these events as excuses for riot and drunkenness, actively suppressing them by the 1850s. Professionalism sparked controversy in the 1880s. Clubs used subterfuges to maintain amateur status, finding players nominal jobs, leaving money in coats, paying inflated expenses. William McGregor, Aston Villa's Scottish draper manager, proposed a solution inspired by county cricket, elite clubs playing a fixed schedule. This created the 1888 Football League with 12 founding members, generating regular, profitable matches and transforming football from folk game to big business. Money drove this transformation. These commercial entities required considerable capital investment and served millions, creating a genuine leisure industry. Joint stock companies funded ventures through share offerings, while managers moved freely between different branches, from publicans to theater operators, creating a recognizable entertainment industry with its own expertise. Some Victorians condemned commercial leisure entirely. Preacher Charles Spurgeon declared, "Pleasure, so-called, is the murderer of thought," specifically denouncing silly sports the year the Football League began. Certain late Victorian socialists viewed football as empty amusement, occupying mental space better used for contemplating class struggle. Yet these critics scored few victories against leisure entrepreneurs and the pleasure-seeking public. The Victorian entertainment revolution created the foundations for our modern leisure industry. From gin palaces to football stadiums, from music halls to seaside piers, these innovations transformed how people spent their free time. Despite moral opposition, commercial entertainment triumphed because it met genuine public demand for escape, excitement, and communal pleasure. The Victorians weren't the dour, pleasure-averse people of stereotype. They were pioneers of modern mass entertainment who gave us the entertainment tradition we enjoy today.